Okay, welcome to the Cybersecurity Happy Hour podcast. My name is Christy, I'm your host, and this is episode 42. We are going to be speaking, I have two fantastic guests, Alexander Rogan, Christian Rogan of the Platinum High Integrity Technology, and the title of this podcast is Defenders of the Cyberverse. We're going to get some insights from these great men. Okay, so Alexander, do you want to introduce yourself? Just tell us about yourself and your background and your achievements.
Oh, well, okay. It's going to be short and sweet then, isn't it? So I'm Alexander Rogan. I'm the CEO, and with Christian, I'm the co-founder of Platinum High Integrity Technologies. We are a cybersecurity company, and we are bringing a particularly interesting cybersecurity solution to the market. It's a technology that Christian actually introduced me to a good few years ago.
Yes.
And it's one that I became really enamored with. It's very powerful tech. I got involved 6 or 7 years ago as a reseller of the tech. Okay. And then a few years ago, I was able to sit down and negotiate with the original architect of the security technology, and persuade him that it would be a good idea for him to sell the tech and let Christy and I bring it to a much bigger market. So there you go. That's me.
That's okay. Awesome. Thank you. Thank you for that. And Christian?
Yeah, I've been in cybersecurity since 2000. I started off with PwC at a small outfit called Be Trusted, which engaged with PKI at that time, and X509 certificates, if anyone even remembers those. Moved over to Message Labs a couple of years later, which was a startup in the email hygiene in the cloud space, and had a very successful 7 years there, where that business was ultimately sold to Symantec for nearly $1 billion. Moved into a number of other security companies, did some consultancy in the middle, worked for Alcatel-Lucent, worked for CSC, Trend Micro, and ended up coming across this incredible technology from a small company called Abartis. So I joined that little startup, which wasn't terribly sophisticated from the commercial perspective. So it didn't succeed like many companies. And Alexander and I were able then to acquire the technology in June 2022, take it back into our labs, improve upon it. And then in the last 6 months or so, we are taking this solution, this unique solution, to market.
Okay, great to hear that. Now, you know that in our industry, that malware is a constant and evolving threat. And what I mean by that is we seem to be playing whack-a-mole, where we have sealed a point and something else pops up. Now, how does your solution adapt to these new and emerging threats? Because as we know that there are very techniques some of these cyber criminals are using, and some countries also kind of have research labs to implement these changes as soon as, let's say, opening has been blocked.
Yeah, we call them zero days, and there's a big and valuable industry in selling, marketing and selling the zero days for exploit of vulnerabilities in corporate and government systems. The surprising answer is we don't adapt our technology at all, because we recognize malware for what it is, and that is it's a binary. Now, when you're trying to introduce any form of malware after the breach onto a system, we simply intercept it at that juncture and prevent the payload from being delivered to the host. And we do that at ring zero, whereby you can't obfuscate what the code is. So we make the system, the operating system, immutable by sitting inside the kernel, becoming intrinsic to that operating system. This gives us a multitude of benefits, which we probably won't even have time to go into here today. But simply put, we apply our code. It's a ring zero kernel level filter driver. It doesn't require any updates, and it absolutely stops with complete certainty any new binaries being introduced to the persistent storage of the device. That means you cannot write to disk without being permissioned onto the system. And we have a whole policy engine, security policy engine, which allows you to approve supply chain that you trust to make necessary changes through the life cycle of the applications that are running on your system. So it is not simply something which will block the utility of the computer. In fact, it absolutely allows the utility of the computer with full flexibility, but will absolutely deny any manner of threat, whatever the attack surface is. So we're talking about protection against USB, even infrared, a malware broker sitting on the computer and trying to type the malware into the machine itself because they've got physical access. They'll be absolutely prohibited from doing that. So to break it down, the way that the kernel level filter driver works is it brings zero, as I said, and it intercepts all the input output traffic, and it will make a deterministic decision as to whether that is a recognized binary that's been permissioned, or a new one, or one that is trying to change a pre-existing binary, or indeed remove a binary. Because one of the attacks is to remove security control from a system. One, of course, is to change it, to adapt it, to make it vulnerable. And the third one would be to introduce a whole new set of code to obviously attack the system. All three types are absolutely prohibited.
Okay. Well, you said, I don't want to use that word, big claim. You said it does not require updates. As we're aware, other vendors, if you do not update signatures, then you're particularly vulnerable. This is quite a novel thing to hear.
Christine, our technology, it's not reliant upon heuristics, behavioral analysis.
Yeah.
It's not reliant upon whitelisting. As Christian said, it's a deterministic filter driver that embeds itself into the operating system. So it actually becomes a part of the computer. And it lives right in the heart of the computer, right in ring zero.
So yes.
Our competitor vendors are sat in the application layer.
Yeah.
They're in a different part of the computer system. And Abatis is looking for binaries, code, trying to get onto the computer system without permission. And that's deterministic. It makes that decision and it stops unwanted binaries in less than a millionth of a second.
Okay.
So, and it stops the bad guys getting onto the computer system before they have a chance. So we hit them at their most vulnerable place. Mm. And that's just when they're about to try and deploy the malware. They're trying to get the payload onto the computer.
Yes.
And Abatis says no.
Okay. Awesome. Now, we're aware that there are different ways of, obviously, malware coming onto our system. One, obviously, USB, clicking malicious links and redirected to websites, et cetera, et cetera. So what you're saying is, whatever the avenue of input, Abatis will stop it on its tracks.
Yeah, because the guy who architected this, the guy who wrote this, was obviously a really clever guy. You know, I mean, we talk about people with brains the size of a planet. I mean, I do think that this chap was one of those.
Yeah.
And his genius was understanding how malware works in its most simplistic form. And he came up with a solution based on that. And this solution is the polar opposite of everything else that's out there. It's an incredibly elegant solution to a really ugly problem. It's a very small piece of code, less than 100 kilobytes.
Okay.
And it sits in ring zero and it looks at the malware as the malware tries to arrive and be delivered onto the computer system. And as Christian rightly said, malware is an unwanted binary. It's a piece of code.
Yes.
And ones and zeros. That's all it is. And if you can stop it from being delivered, if you can stop that payload from arriving on the computer system, you can stop that malware doing what the bad guys are trying to do. And it doesn't matter whether they're trying to deliver it by infrared or whether it's a watering hole attack on a website or whether it's a USB stick as the ingress point. Abatis doesn't care. It doesn't matter. It doesn't even need to know that. What it's seeing is unwanted code. So it breaks it down into something really simple. And because of that, it can react, or it can act incredibly quickly. So one of the points I like to make is compare it stopping malware being delivered onto a computer system within less than a millionth of a second and compare that to the average time it takes now to actually find and clear malware off from an operating system, which I think according to IBM is over 100 days.
Yes, sometimes in some instances, some of them it's very hard to do. You just have to either rewrite the system, or I think if I remember clearly, there was an attack in one of the oil companies a few years ago, and they had to purchase new hardware and costing them a lot of money.
Absolutely, $300 million. That was Aramco with Shiv Moon.
Aramco. Yes. So, and I remember they had to, because of the scale of the attack, they had to give oil and gas for free for a period of time. So obviously, I'm not sure what the long-term cost was now, but if they are, I suppose if they had this piece of software, it would have reduced that landscape drastically. Now, you've kind of walked us through the fundamentals of and the functionalities of the Avast software. And you also talked about how they enhance cybersecurity. And also now you've also mentioned about being a solution for zero-day exploits and any unknown malware. Okay, which is great to hear. I'm just going to go in again now. And again, this piece of software, just 100 kilobytes, resides in ring zero. A question I want to ask is, now, obviously, we are aware that malicious codes and the binary can be recognized. Are there any false positives here?
No. No, we don't suffer from false positives or false negatives. So it's one of the great benefits of the technology, because it recognizes and it's an actual event. And if it stops a binary, we record it in our logs. Yeah. That goes to our SIM, which we call Central Management Console. That's a syslog that's ported off the agent that sits on each of the endpoints, goes to the SIM, our SIM, and that records for posterity the event that's actually happened. But because it's a deterministic decision on a binary that's tried to write to disk, there are no false positives. So we're pretty good as a hunter killer for pre-existing malware as well when it tries to morph on the device. So if you have a already infected device before we're installed, that there are instances where we have actually discovered pre-existing ransomware because it's tried to morph, it's tried to call out to its command and control on the internet, get a new profile to evade signature, because very often ransomware is discovered, you know, by other security vendors signatured, and then the signatures are rolled out to pre-existing security vendors so that they can adapt their solution to meet the emerging threat. We see it when it tries to morph, and therefore we capture where it was originally on the disk, and therefore we can do a targeted removal. But the beauty of our system is there are no false negatives and no false positives, and also an extremely limited number of logs. The logs are low because we are stopping the attack before it follows through.
Okay.
And that's really important when you think of the cost downstream to all the logging that every other security vendor has to go through. So if you think about the Target attack a few years ago where they had deployed FireEye, FireEye said, yes, we identified there was a threat and it was in the lines of code that we reported to you. Well, unfortunately for Target, the actual threat was hidden in amongst a million lines of other false positives. So they couldn't distinguish the wheat from the chaff, so to speak. So the logging aspect to me is one of my favorite aspects of our technology because of the sheer cost reduction. So the ROI for our technology compared to almost, well, every other actually security solution that's out there is dramatic, absolutely dramatic. And that comes back through having that surety of no false positives and obviously the vastly reduced log set. I just wanted to point out, because some of the listeners will be saying, well, it's all very well protecting against persistent threat and binaries that write to the disk, but what about the tools that APT groups such as Vault Typhoon use? They co-opt PowerShell, they're using VBScript, they're using some of these other approved solutions that the administrators use. Well, one, with our technology, a BARTIS administrator has a higher level of privilege than a normal sysadmin. So where you would normally be god of the box and you can do anything you wish with the system, with a BARTIS deployed, you have to be an BARTIS approved administrator. and that means to allow the unlocking of the operating system by the sysadmin. So the sysadmin is no longer in control of the estate. So we actually stop the insider threat as well as the external threat.
Do you think organizations would be comfortable handing over the keys of the kingdom to a third party as admin?
In many instances, for small to medium businesses, they do that already with outsourcing to cloud.
Yes.
So that paradigm shift's already occurred. But you're quite right. Many governments, many large companies, as we've mentioned, Aramco, very much would not allow third parties to come in and enforce control, change control. So we are quite able with our solution to give them, one, a managed service or oversight of that managed service, or they can own and operate the solution themselves with minimal training. It's a very, very simple solution to deploy using conventional tools.
Yeah.
Obviously, we use IP. Syslogs come from our endpoints, protected endpoints, to our SIM, or indeed they can have their own pane of glass that they may have already invested in, such as the ArcSight or a Splunk or any of those. So we play nice with all of the other security solutions in the stack. We do not, because we're only at Ring Zero. Go ahead, Alexander.
Yes. Yeah, but Christy, just, the point about handing over the security, I mean, what we're doing here is actually enhancing the security. So the way that we will build ourselves in with the clients is that you won't have a single point of failure. So one person can't switch it off. So you've almost got like the missile silo analogy where two guys have got to turn the keys simultaneously.
Exactly.
So depending upon the size of the estate and, the locations, you could have somebody who doesn't even know the other person on another continent at a time, at a predefined time, two people working, turning that key so you can make any amendments or changes you need to do, and then locking it again.
Yeah.
And you make it almost impossible. I mean, you can never say never and you can never say impossible, but, almost impossible for the bad guys to co-opt somebody.
Yes.
So you can't force somebody because there's somebody else on another continent that has to be involved.
You prevent the collusion. Yeah.
You prevent collusion. And if somebody's having a bad day, as happens, well, tough. That person having a bad day can't do the damage because they need to have somebody on the other side of the world and they don't know who that person is.
Yes.
So what we're doing is adding a higher level of privilege and a much, much greater solution to these organizations.
Okay.
I just wanted to finish the point on the APT group, Vault Typhoon, as well, because they are known for using the low and slow approach and using the administrator's own tools against them, such as PowerShell, VBScript, Cscript, and so on. And they have a very, very modest persistency on the device, which is extremely hard to find. So this is what Christopher Wray, the FBI director in the States, has called an existential and generational threat to critical national infrastructure, particularly in federal government in the States. Because the Vault Typhoon APT group has been in their system since before 2021. I think they're saying, to their knowledge, about 5 years.
Yeah.
So what you have there is a threat actor that has now actually permeated the operational technology space within those large utilities, those water providers, energy providers, nuclear power stations, and so on and so forth, but simply because they're able to use your own administrator tools against you once they've exploited the vulnerability on the system. If you deployed a BARTIS in that scenario, we are able, by virtue of our complete control over the binaries, to prohibit the use, even by system administrators, of their own tool sets. Never mind the operational technology where you've deployed tens of thousands of programmable logic controls across a power station, for example, that they still have the same operating system. They still have the same ability to be vulnerable because these tools exist. We can absolutely turn it off across those tools off across an entire estate, allow only the highest level of privilege, which would be a BARTIS approved operator, to utilize those tools. For everyone else, it can be completely turned off, negating the risk. Now, because we can do that after instantiation with the security policy that we deploy, the deployment model is using the conventional tools. The minute we're instantiated, it requires a restart because we do exist in the kernel. We become part of an intrinsic to the operating system. because that's how it works, you have to do a restart. But once the restart is done, that means you can then invoke the policy, which would say, I'm going to turn off all of those administrator tools. And that would prevent any attack group that's in there that utilizing the administrator tool set would prohibit them from acting. And the moment that small, that modest persistent threat that's sitting there, which allows them to invoke the tools, tries to invoke the tools, is prohibited, but it immediately becomes visible to us. So we capture that event in the log. It's a true event. It's not a false positive. Mm-hmm. It's absolute. And we can then identify where the bad actor, the APT group, such as Vault Typhoon, are across the network, and then enable a targeted removal of their presence. And that may be the most innocuous looking bit of code. Yeah. You might not think it was malicious, but of course the bad actor knows it's malicious because that's what they're using to deny availability at such juncture. They perhaps want to mount an attack in conjunction with an invasion of Taiwan, for example, because Vault Typhoon is a Chinese group. So this is how we can enable and secure operational technology as well as IT. Uniquely, the Abatis technology has been around. We forgot to mention this, Alexander. We were commissioned by the Swiss military in 2004 and deployed in 2005 into Armour Suisse in the Swiss Alps on behalf of the Swiss military. And that means that it was written for very, very much earlier versions of Windows. So we, in fact, have in our library, a software library, the ability to go back to NT4. To protect the endpoints all the way to the present day, which is completely and utterly unique in our industry.
I was just going to ask you that about the legacy systems, because we talked about critical systems, and we are aware that some of the causes of the vulnerabilities in those infrastructure is legacy systems that no longer have...
Essentially, they're unsupported, Christy.
Exactly, yes.
Systems, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, whatever vulnerabilities that exist remain to this day. But with our solution, you don't even need to patch until you are good and ready. So let's say you've deployed Cisco and then you now know there's a vulnerability within the WebEx aspect of the Cisco architecture. And you have an issue now because, do I deploy their fix to fix the vulnerability? Do I wait and test that fix in pre-production to ensure that that itself has not been compromised, such as SolarWinds, where supply chain was compromised? What do I do? The IT professional, security professional has a conundrum. Do I trust Microsoft to allow them to push out KBs across my estate? Or do I wait and test? In the meantime, I remain vulnerable, especially if that vulnerability is being exploited in the wild.
Yeah.
Now, with our solution, you can, because the vulnerability cannot be exploited, because we will not allow a change to the pre-existing binary, because there's no change allowed, the vulnerability is not exposed. So the only reason that you would need to update your patch effectively is through regulatory means, because the regulator has demanded that you have to update your systems within 2 weeks of a patch becoming available. Otherwise, you could do that at a, you know, twice yearly event. You could consolidate all your updates and you could roll them out consistently and all at once across an estate, negating a lot of expensive out-of-band patching and emergency patching. That goes away with our technology. Okay. So that means that the vulnerability, even though it exists, cannot be exploited while we're doing the protection. So another very powerful USP for our technology.
Okay, now,
just to reiterate, it will sit on everything from the current flavor of the Windows operating systems all the way back to NT4. And that's the original question. Yeah, so it looks after all of the legacy estate, all of it. So where you've got organizations, we've got the National Health Service, we've got the police forces, they're up until very recently running XP. Or Windows 7 or Windows 8, Abatis will sit on those and it will provide the same level of surety and security as it does for Windows 11 or Server 12 or anywhere else it sits on in the modern stack, in the modern architecture. And this is just something I'd like to add.
Yes.
This means that if you are running Abatis on your legacy equipment, on your older IT, you will update that IT when you are ready not because you're being strong-armed by a vendor saying you've got to throw that machine away because we can't look after it anymore. There might be years of life left in that machine. It might be doing a really simple application. Well, you don't need to upgrade it to Windows 10 or 11 at that expense.
And there's good examples of that are MRI scanners and X-ray machines, medical devices, in broadcast satellite communications. All of those use legacy OS because it can't be changed.
That's too costly, and some of the vendors have gone out of business, etc. Okay, now I want to come into this personally, as because I conduct audits for compliance purposes, and one of the in the UK, I'm a cybersecurity assessor, and one of the standard questions we ask is, has your software been updated with the latest patches for the vendor patch within 14 days? Now, I'm looking at this that if they say no, but claim that we have Abartis installed that manages all our operating systems going back to XP, I'm not sure if the current standard will allow us to pass them, because as far as the current ISO 27001 external other standards as well, is that do you have, what's your operating system? It is Windows 22H2, that is fine. If you have XP, it's an automatic fail. If these clients say we have Windows, let's say Windows XP, for example, and we have Abartis as software that is providing that control, are you telling me that they might pass the certification, that an auditor and assessor might pass them?
Well, Christy, yes. Microsoft are not issuing patches for XP anymore.
They don't. No, we know that. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So yes. So this is a way that you could tick that box and say it's now protected. That's the question. It's protected because Microsoft are not issuing patches. Refuse to. Unless in certain situations where, like the National Health or perhaps the police forces are being forced to pay a huge amount of money every month as an extended license.
Yes.
For a support that is actually no support. So this goes back to return on investment. There was a dreadful story that came out a few months ago where the National Health paid Microsoft or its reseller £8 million extended licenses for a month.
Yeah.
Just a staggering amount of money. Yeah. And that was so that they could run machines that were not actually being patched or supported.
Well, I suppose if you look at the return on investment, £8 million compared to...
Look after the entire National Health for less than £8 million, just out of the fact that we would really like to look after the National Health.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
The amount of money that is being burned is absolutely horrendous. So the return on investment would be massive and immediate. But the point is if you don't have to upgrade, because you don't want to, then don't. Yes. In addition, you're buying security.
Yes.
Whereas at the moment, if you're paying for an extended license or not, you've got no security.
No.
And all you have to do is look at the number of patches and the number of critical vulnerabilities that are being applied against even the modern, not legacy, but even the modern architecture. Congress are saying it's not fit for purpose. Now, it's not my place to sort of say whether, Microsoft are or are they not. But if you see the reports that are coming out by organizations or politicians who have got some sway with Microsoft, very, very recently, just after the Vault Typhoon attack, when they suddenly realized, the problem they've got with the critical infrastructure, the CISA attack, where another APT group got into the US body that was there to advise and protect other US bodies. I mean, the irony is enormous. Right. People are getting upset with it now.
As you can see, as you know, as Christian said, a lot of the companies, the SMEs and the micro organizations do not have the in-house support and the expertise in-house. So,
which is why we have a managed security service.
Yes.
Our technology is supported by an international patent. Yes. We're filing new patents because we've actually improved the security since we bought it. So now we have the ability to stop the living off the land binaries, which I was talking about earlier. Yeah. That is the PowerShells, the VB scripts, the C scripts that the bad guys are using against you. Yeah. We also came up with a solution to the SMB1 problem, the server message block problem one, which is an incredible vulnerability that allows and has to be used for legacy to talk to the more modern architecture. If you don't have SMB1, then you can't operate remotely your operational technology estate. So that means that SMB1 is switched on across your modern IT estate. And this is what's keeping the SOC analysts up at night, causing them massive amount of stress simply because they're having to monitor all the transaction flows through SMB1 because it's highly vulnerable to man-in-the-middle attacks because there is no encryption. The devices cannot support encryption. So this is as a threat vector. So we can actually turn off that SMB1 conduit once we're deployed on an estate. This means that the SOC analysts now kind of get their work-life balance back because they're no longer under huge amount of pressure. We hear anecdotally some of the events I've been to in the last few months that 52% of SOC analysts are on some form of Prozac, you know, taking medication to handle their stress levels. Fully 65% of them want to get out of the business. Well, one of the presentations I saw, a guy put up a picture of three old men and said these are actually 22-year-olds, and I got a big laugh from the audience because of the stress these poor SOC analysts are under. With our technology deployed, that goes away and we can reduce the number of staff required. I mean, we had a very large Middle Eastern customer that we're working with right now who have two data centers in the education sector. Yeah. And they did their numbers at the outset to how many folks would they need to run a SOC. Okay, we'll go with 50 in each. And they suddenly realized, being in a rather totalitarian type of regime, where if you get things wrong, the potential repercussions are much broader than getting fired. The stress that these individuals are under, the SOC analysts are under, was so great that fully half of them were off sick at any one time due to stress.
Yeah.
So now to deploy, so they now have 240 people across two data centers to do the same task because of the stress levels.
Yeah, that's a shame.
Yeah.
It is, because I mean, I hear personally of people actually leaving that sector of the industry due to stress and burnouts as well.
But you deploy our technology, the white noise goes away. You get to see an actual event, the attempt as it comes in. The attempt is immediately prevented, as Alizana said, in less than a millionth of a second. But you've recorded it. You know that it happened, and it makes life so much simpler. We reduce the complexity. You can imagine when a security event happens and you've got maybe, if you're a large corporate, you may have upwards of 25 different vendor security vendors in your stack.
Yeah.
And they're all reporting on the same security incident as it goes lateral across the network.
Yes.
You're looking at thousands upon thousands of lines of logs that increase exponentially at the point when there's something suspected to be wrong.
Uh-huh.
So SolarWinds would typically collate and gather and aggregate all of those logs. And we've seen from a report from 2012, some years ago now, what actually happens during a security event to all of those devices that are now communicating to the SOC and the NOC.
Yeah.
And the absolute snowball that you get of logs, it goes up, I think, thousandfold from steady state to 1,000-fold. And that is, and then do you know if it's a credible threat or is it a false positive? So these are substantial issues for the modern day SOC providers. And now what they need to do is to add a SOAR to the mix because the SIM's not doing enough. Ooh. And if you haven't got a SOAR, then the SOAR is now also unable to do the tasks that are now required because of the sheer number of logs. Mm-hmm. So now we're talking about, or competitors are talking about, adding AI to the mix. And now we're adding more complexity.
Exactly.
And
now, you mentioned SMB version 1 and the security operating center. What came to mind as well as companies that frequently do vulnerability scans and also pen testing as well, the SMB version one will come up as a criticality, I think, of over CVS 7 or above. And what's came to mind now, since you mentioned a SOC, I wondered if your solution can also address some of the findings we get from running these scans as well. Because I think some of our own clients is one, they do a vulnerability scan, unfortunately don't do it frequently. And some of these categorization of high security comes up. People start pulling out their hair. I just wondered if this would be something that, as we mentioned before, small and medium companies can implement early before any kind of compliance, either PCI DSS or Sarbanes-Oxley or an ISO audit. I'm just thinking how this will help them as well, if this is in place, probably.
So what we do when we introduce ourselves to a new customer, yes, we go onto their site and we put our code onto their subset of their devices, usually from different departments, so we can look at the assets, the software assets that are actually running. So we then compile a list and we run the logs that we've gathered in learn mode. So we're not making any change. We're benign on the endpoint. We're not making any deterministic decision. We're just sitting there recording what's actually on the endpoint.
Yeah.
And that's akin to a software asset management piece of our investigation, our discovery phase. We pass that through some algorithms, AI algorithms, back at our research facility and machine learning. Mm-hmm. And we then produce a report. We go back to the client, to the customer, and say, this is what we discovered on these endpoints. Is this true and correct? Did you know that you had AnyDesk running on this machine? Did you know that you had, because you didn't tell us you had, you know, a particular security vendor, because something had been left behind and was now sitting on the system, had never been removed, is now unpatched and highly vulnerable. And it could be you're talking to a bank and they have no idea that these software assets are actually still sitting there. So we are able to discover all types of code that tries to update itself or runs. And that way, we can then help advise the client, the customer, what they need to do to clean up their system, and then create a security policy for them that reflects their risk appetite. Now, this is a really important piece, because I imagine that some listeners will be thinking, well, this is a highly restrictive system. Mm. This couldn't be deployed in a dynamic environment. It's too inflexible. Well, that would be wrong, because we can create security policies that meet the exact risk appetite down to an individual machine or 10,000 machines. We can create a policy and give it to our customers and say, deploy this and this will meet your absolute risk appetite. Tailored for you, dependent on the applications you actually want running. Because very often we'll go to a university and we'll find a game server that shouldn't be sitting there, because people are messing around playing at night. And this is usually sometimes in the IT teams as well. They're consuming valuable resources and not realizing they're introducing risk to their environment. They're not necessarily malicious. They're just bored late at night. They want to play games. So they think, I'll deploy a game server. Or we find cryptocurrency mining.
Yeah,
that's incredibly energy intensive and costly for a university who can't afford to support that kind of scenario. So we are able to find all these sorts of things on first deployment in learn mode. And then, as I said, once we've gone through discovery phase with the customer, we can then tailor a security policy that fits their absolute risk appetite and what should be running, what is permissioned on those systems. And that's incredibly powerful, because when you do your audit, you can say with true conviction, this is what we have running. These are the assets. There's nothing else on here. And we can prove that through the logs. And that then brings in the cyber insurer. How do I get my estate insured against threat? And the things that we're finding talking to insurers now is that they're more concerned about the insider threat almost than they are the external threat. Because if you've got an individual who's got sysadministrator rights having a bad day, going through a divorce or had a row with his boss, he could introduce elements of risk to that organization, or they could leave something behind before when they get fired, something terribly nasty. And this is the uninsurable risk. This is where the real challenge comes in. So Alexander, talking about that high level of privilege and control, where you need to have proper collusion across several staff members to introduce new risks is a lot harder than dealing with a single, than managing, you know, the threat of a single sysadmin who's you've now got oversight and control over what actually they're doing.
So you have that even when you, GTS. Okay, now most organizations, they will have a group policy, and also their applications are managed by Intune. So if I'm coming from the client point of view, because they're going to come up with these answers. Okay, we have this already. How come your pieces of software found this and the ones we're paying for already didn't actually give us this, find these rogue software, and we thought we had controls already through group policy, etc.? How would you answer that?
We've had those conversations and they are pretty tough.
They work. The processes work differently, Christy. And you've got to ask yourself the question: if you are, you know, using any of the vendors that are out and you're hacked, ask yourself the question: you know, does what I have on my machine work? Well, if you've been hacked, the answer is no. Why is your vendor telling you it's not a question of if you're going to get breached, it's when you're going to get breached? Why are they telling you that? The other question is, why are you accepting that? They're selling something that they know doesn't actually stop the problem.
Yeah. And I think they understand that the client is ignorant of the threats. That's why. So you get the salesperson come to them and say, okay, this provides this solution, and because obviously they don't have the knowledge behind that, it's okay, then that works for us, and then they implement it, and that's the end of it.
Yeah. I think it doesn't work, and then in 6 months' time they'll come along with something else.
Yeah,
and then they'll come along with something else.
Yeah,
and then they'll come along with something else. And this is, I think it's called tool sprawl. Yeah, this is where the tools are being sold.
Yes.
To the client who's looking to buy some surety and security are getting more and more complex, more and more expensive, and there are more and more of them. There's something like 75 different sets of tools, security tools, used to protect an average business now. Mm-hmm. Certainly, enterprise is more than that. I mean, we know banks have got up to 100 different levels of security products in their stack, and they still cannot stop the zero day.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the tools that are out there at the moment don't work. Oh. And that's the fact.
We think the situation is going to get rapidly worse because of the advent of generative AI and being able to string together multiple exploits and use them in a single attack by GAI will absolutely introduce weaponized software into large institutions very, very rapidly now. And we're seeing some researchers in Israel that have proven, and they've strung together two or three of these now and proven that they just sail through all the defenses.
So this
capability is obviously going to be utilized by nation state, and will eventually, of course, travel down to the ransomware type gangs, because very often there's what's the guy who's working nation state during the week is then out for himself, particularly from Russia at weekends, to monetize his skills. And so they'll be taking those skills and capabilities and deploying them for ransomware, which is obviously financial gain as opposed to the nation state, which might be to deny availability.
And Christy, the solution the industry is coming up with at the moment is, don't worry about the AI generated threat. We will have the AI generated security.
Defense. Yeah.
We're seeing this coming in now.
Yes.
So
yeah.
The SOC didn't work. The CM in the SOC didn't work. So they introduced the SOAR.
Yeah.
The SOAR is not working.
Yeah.
So now they're introducing the AI to support the SOAR, to support the SOC.
Yeah.
It's almost like that old, you know, the man who swallowed a fly, and you know, the whole, you know, it's just how it's unraveling. It's crazy. It's
they've descended into a rabbit warren, not a rabbit hole, as I like to say. And what we're seeing then with the advent of utilizing AI for this, that is really, really cost prohibitive because it uses an enormous amount of energy. To run an AI is hugely energy consumptive. So your costs are going to go up again. Yes. Now, with our solution, we actually reduce the energy required on the endpoint because not only do we stop malicious binaries or new binaries coming on, but across data center, we've proven that deploying Abatis across 2,000 servers, for example, reduces the energy consumption by roughly 7.5%. And that report was done by Lockheed Martin back in 2015. So we can also reduce the energy consumption as well as massively improving the security stance. And we can bring for C-suite some surety back to the change control process so that they know that they're not going to be in the car park at 4 o'clock in the morning talking to reporters, a gaggle of reporters, because they've just lost a load of valuable IP or customer data, you know, has happened many, many times over the last few years. So if you think about the cost implications of running a PR team, the disaster recovery, the business continuity planning, everything that goes with that, the backups, that the, you know, all the huge cost associated with maintaining and testing all of that, it's just the cost implications are utterly, utterly immense. And this we believe this is out of control. And we also think that the spend, the corporate spend by the security vendors, is it now roughly 80 to 100 billion a year in marketing to keep this mess afloat is utterly ridiculous. So energy consumption's gone up massively. The complexity's gone up.
Yeah.
One of the major banks that we've talked to, their biggest risk as they see it is vendor management. If they've got 75 vendors looking after a global bank, imagine how many meetings that goes down to, because you've got to have a quarterly meeting with your vendor. You've got to have patches from them day in, day out, emergency patches, regular patches, new features that you might want to deploy. You've got to have that relationship with them. That's a space in the car park. That's an additional coffee machine. That's more office space, meeting space, just for the security vendors. And of course, that moves into the NOC as well, not just the SOC, because they're all linked. So the cost implications moving forward, if this carries on the path it's going and you don't do the prevention, not cure, as we are maintaining you need to do, the reactive approach requires a victim. Somebody gets clobbered and then they come out with a fix and then you've got to roll it out. And then you've got to hope that that fix doesn't contain something malicious because the bad guys have got into the security vendors because that's who they're targeting.
And then the fix as well doesn't affect on the application or the system. And
now take a vendor like us whose code never changes.
Yeah.
So you checksum it, you deploy it, you never touch it. Therefore, it can't be made vulnerable. And our solution is also hardened as well. So it's self-protecting because you can't get hacking tools onto the machine that we sit on. You can't remove us. You can't affect us. So we are security hardened as well.
Okay. Now, you mentioned costs, and with every business, they look at their budgets. So I just want to look at how would you, let me put this in there. How would you, is that about the software remains cost-effective for organization, especially in the light of budget constraints and resource limitations? Because as you know, vendors tend to sell the products, let's say, this is just general, £100 per user. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, for the first 2 years, it will stay £100. But unfortunately, year three, it goes up to £150, £200. How would you manage, how can this be cost effective for the clients in the long term?
Well, our business model is built around that, Christy. Yes. So because we've got this principled and simple principle of stopping malware, we don't have to keep coming back and sell something else. You know, we're not going down into that rabbit warren that Christian referenced, that rabbit hole. Yeah. The other way of doing it, the way that our peers are providing security protection with the industry at the moment, it is just to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And whether they like it or not, they're adding, as they add more complexity, they're adding a greater attack surface.
Yes.
And obviously they're coming back for more money. Well, with Abatis, you don't have to do that. You deploy it. It stops malware, as I said right back at the beginning, at its most vulnerable point. So it's proactive. Every other model that you've described, every other situation you've described, is a reactive solution, which is no solution at all. As Christian said, it requires a victim.
Yes.
And in some cases, it's not one victim, but it's tens of thousands. Look at NotPetya.
Yeah.
A few years ago. So it was a Russian attack on accounting systems in Ukraine, got into Odessa port within no time. I'm not talking less than seconds. Odessa port was being hit in the Black Sea, almost identical time. Cadbury's had a biscuit factory in Tasmania get knocked over by the same malware. And Cadbury's obviously spend an awful lot of money on their security.
Yes.
Yeah. And this unknown sliced through absolutely everything. And the cybersecurity vendors will say, we'll find the problem, we'll issue the fix, we'll get the patch out, and everybody's got to be happy. NotPetya cost the world $10 billion in damages.
So it killed companies. It killed TNT, I believe, didn't it? And Merck nearly went to the wall.
No, it didn't. Be careful what you say. It didn't kill them at all. It cost them a lot of money. Did huge, $10 billion worth of harm. Many companies fall over. Many companies don't come back from these cyber attacks. So this, the question is not just, are you going to be protecting my budget in 2 years, or are you going to come back in 2 years and put the price up? It's like, are those businesses going to be there in 2 years? Yeah, the amount of attacks is growing exponentially faster than the money can be spent to secure against it. I mean, the damage that's being done to the world economy is greater now than the Chinese GDP. Yeah, there's like loads of stats out there that you can draw on that just tell you how big and how scary this problem is at the moment. And we just don't think the current methodology is good enough.
Okay.
And what we do for our managed service customers, Christy, is we'll sign a contract with them for 3 or 5 years.
Yes.
And then they can fix their costs. And with our technology, they know what their security budget is going to be. With every other solution that's out there, it's an unknown and it's escalating. And the board is absolutely fed up with having to come up with more and more money, having been told this will solve the issue, and this issue is never solved.
Okay. I'll give you an example, Christy.
Yeah.
One of our larger clients, who are in the education sector, I sat down with them, and I said what I thought the biggest problem was to them. And the first was I reckoned that their costs were out of control. And that they were buying more and more and more from the vendors. The hackers, the bad actors outside of the education sector are a given. Yeah. And and it's almost as though, they're part of society, whether it's good or bad. But the fact that they were having to spend and that their spend was out of control made that as great a problem as it was from their beloved students who loved nothing better than trying to hack the school systems as well. Yes. So
insider threat, yes.
So but when you've got the insider threat and you're not stopping it, and when you're adding more and more systems to your cybersecurity defenses and you're not stopping it, the fact that your costs are going out of control gets more than a little bit upsetting.
Yes, of course.
These organizations are not saying no.
No.
They're writing the checks, they're paying the money, and they're still getting breached. It's not right. It's not fair.
No, it's not. But the thing is that they have to do something. They have to show sort of a due diligence. They have to show that they've been proactive in attempting to stop these threats. Because if they do nothing, then obviously they're negligent. So if one piece of solution doesn't work, then they have to find somewhere, because again, in some of these organizations, schools, even the schools are universal charities, you have shareholders, they have to answer to different stakeholders. So they have to appear to be doing something. Okay, I'm going to ask you the final question. Looking ahead, what are your plans for further development and improvement of cybersecurity solution? I know you said that at the moment it is, I don't want to use the word static, but surely there is room for improvement in the future.
I totally agree with you. I mean, we just filed for a number of new patents for the next generation of Abartis. And we're actually spending an awful lot on research and development. You know, so we are a dynamic business, very much not static. So yes, we are investing in the future. You know, we're putting a lot of money into the development of our AI. You know, regardless of what I say about how our competitors work, you know, we're very much interested in making sure that we've got decent AI that's working for us. Okay. So that is consuming a fair amount of time, resource, and money. We're also looking at areas where Abartis traditionally hasn't sat. File protection, as an example. So, you know, that's not been something that Abartis has been particularly relevant for. But, you know, that's now changing. So, you know, I don't want to say a great deal about what we're doing because we are protecting our IP at the moment. But yes, we're sort of confident that we've got more solutions in the pipeline. Also, you know, talking of that, we are working on Abartis for the cellular market. So we will have Abartis for Android.
Oh, that's awesome.
One of the clients that we're talking to, we're about building a Play Store so we can look at the apps that are coming into the Play Store and make sure there are no back doors in there. There's no spyware or malware.
Yes.
And then we can provide a custodian for those apps and making sure that nothing can be added to it or changed whilst it's in the client's Play Store. And then when it's deployed onto the cell phone, well, the cell phone's protected by Abartis, and you know we stop anything bad happening there. So that's actually part and parcel of what we're doing at the moment.
Okay, would that be a package deal? Because organization issues, advice on laptops,
the client I'm talking about, so it's a major telecom provider.
Okay,
so they will be able to bring that out to, you know, the millions of clients that they've got. Undoubtedly, they will, you know, they'll be selling telephones to their clients through their, you know, their network of shops or their online facilities. They'll just start selling telephones with Abartis fitted.
Okay, well, that would be good.
We've spoken mostly about Microsoft, but obviously, if we're going to do Android, that's based on Unix, Linux originally. So we have the capability to provide security for Linux right now. So that's something that we develop for some larger customers for specific versions that they're running, but we can compile our code to be effective in Linux as well currently. The other aspect that we're looking to is to be embedded in IoT. So we're actually built into the operating systems of the Internet of Things. Because if you can imagine, you've got millions upon millions of devices being deployed, which are essentially dumb, but they're connected through IP. They are a major conduit for DDoS attacks by the bad actors again, and we can absolutely prevent them being repurposed by malicious actors. So there's a big play for us there.
A great example of that is that urban myth about, you know, 10 million toothbrushes being co-opted to be part of the huge DDoS attack recently. So it was an urban myth, but Abartis would have stopped it.
Is it like a huge botnet of some sort, is it?
So you could deploy Abartis onto your toothbrush and make sure that the bad guys don't attack it.
So we're also involved in developing for smart cities as well, for smart meters, for going on to, you know, building security so that somebody can't hack a building, so to speak, as we saw in one of the early diehards. We'd absolutely prevent anybody getting in and doing that kind of malicious attack where you could perhaps turn the heating up or off in inclement weather. And also, you wouldn't want somebody else to be, you know, bad actor to be able to attack a city's infrastructure regarding traffic lights and all other stuff, which could potentially cause horrendous accidents. So smart cities is a big thing for us as well.
You mentioned data centers. You mentioned, so what about the embedded environmental controls within the data centers?
Well, we have a huge story with the data center because the amount of water and cooling that's required is reduced. We can extend the life cycle of the spinning disks because the platter, the surface temperature of the platter drops by 8°C. So if you don't want to sweat your assets and use the benefit of our code, you can extend the life cycle of those machines.
Yeah.
So the benefits are just kind of weird and wonderful because you wouldn't think putting a small amount of code onto an operating system would have such a dramatic and positive effect, but it absolutely does. We get accused of pushing snake oil, I might add, at this point when we start talking about energy savings. But it's just the knock-on effect of reducing complexity and introducing simplicity into a model.
Okay, awesome. Now, thank you for that. Thanks, Alex and Christian. Where can listeners find out more information about yourselves, about your company?
They can visit the website, platinum-hit.com. We'll do a Google search for Abartis, which is the name of the product, or Platinum High Integrity Technologies. And then, you know, there's the opportunities to get in contact us through there. And then we're also on social media. So for business, a lot of business actually comes to us through LinkedIn. So, you know, we're all there. People can find us just looking for us by name.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time, Alexander and Christian, and we hope that this episode has provided valuable insights and practical knowledge that you can apply in your own life or work. It's not just about passive listening and taking action. Thank you once again for listening. Have a great day. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Christy. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, Christy.
Thank you. You're welcome.